Excuse me, Hans, do you have
No, David, it said tin machine.
Remember, you're in a band now, David.
This is your quarter.
Yeah.
Do you see tin machine as a long-term project, or is it just the whim?
I don't think project might be the wrong word. I think band is
so
it's the word.
I mean, I'm quite certain if anybody really got bored enough or angry enough or whatever, they'd just take a walk. So it's that kind of, it's just dependent on how we all keep getting on with each other musically and personally.
Hello and welcome back to Album to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. I know it's been an absolute eternity delivering the second instalment of my conversation with Reeves Gabrels, but I promise you it's worth the wait. And I hope you enjoy this second instalment of a chat that we had back in January of this year, 2022, just ahead of what would have been David Bowie's 75th birthday. And that's an anniversary that we're talking about as we start this episode's natter. And we go on to discuss what it's like to lose your hair, get mistaken for David Crosby, buying vibrators from Sydney sex shops, throwing eclairs around on Top of the Pops, giving David Bowie a buzz cut, writing music for Tin Machine, and of course, Weetabix. And in between all that, Reeves gives us the lowdown on the making of Tin Machine 2. So if you're ready, here we go with part two of Reeves Gabrels on Album to Album.
The distance between us age-wise, because there's 10 years between us, did not seem as great when he was 41 and I was 31, you know? And I remember around that time I was working with Nick Lowe, just playing some live gigs, and Nick was 40. But Nick always had already had salt and pepper hair.
Ever since the 70s he's had salt and pepper hair, hasn't he?
And he dressed a little more like an adult, say, you know? Actually, when I met him, he was wearing all denim and a caramel or a buckskin fringed Western jacket.
Well,
matching cowboy boots. And that was just an afternoon. That was sound check.
That must have been that Cash family influence.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Anyway, I just remember thinking to myself, "Wow, Nick really gets around great for an old guy."
It's like Andy Warhol explaining why in the early 60s he started wearing a silver wig. He said, because then everyone would look at me and say, God, he's really spry and active for an old guy. It's a good theory.
Well, you know, I mean, it's been a thing for me. Well, in the mid-90s, I didn't know what color my hair was because from the mid-90s to the late 90s, I was always making it red or just doing shit with it, and I knew it was getting thinner from the time I was in Tin Machine. I could see it, the distance coming.
Yeah,
but I always thought that was, you can get, people don't really pay that close attention, but if you're bald, they notice it immediately.
Yeah,
I know.
Tell me about it.
I'm safe discussing it with you, but I'm still slightly resistant because I've got a little bit left up here.
Yeah.
So you're
handling it well. I saw a press shot of you must playing with The Cure, and you had it all. You know, you had a big halo. Which I thought looked really good.
My goal was to look like Robert's photo negative.
I mean, how old is he now? I mean, he's still got it. He's still got the bird's
nest. He's two years younger than me.
Right, right. Yeah, he's still rocking it. And
And I think if you got it and you enjoy having it, fuck it. You know, let your freak flag fly, as they say.
Let your freak flag fly. There are times when I really wish I still had it. I started losing my hair in my late teens. And so by the time I was in my early 20s, it didn't recede neatly. I remember seeing pictures of you from Tin Machine, and, you know, you could see it's receding politely. Mine just went batshit crazy. I used to have a Robert Smith style do. You know, I was well into The Cure when I was younger. And so I had this big kind of messy thing going on, which was quite good for concealing thinning hair.
But
I know I did the same thing. I did it in 2016. That's what you were seeing pictures from.
It's good for that. You know, a lot of hairspray and, you know, carefully mussing it all up. But I would just start getting at the top, you know, these thin patches. So you'd have a bit of a sprouting bit over there, then you'd have it bushy out over there. And in the end, it just looks so ludicrous. I look like David Crosby, not, you know, Robert Smith. So, you know,
I was early 2000s, I was in living in LA, and I got out of the car one night, and I had grown a Fu Manchu, and my hair was down to here, and I had pointy sideburns, which is the one constant, perhaps. There were people waiting outside this club almost across the street and down a little bit. And I heard someone go, "Look, it's David Crosby." And the guy was the worst thing is the guy was actually serious. And that was, I cut my hair, I think, 2 days later.
Almost cut my hair? I did cut my hair.
I definitely cut my hair.
I don't know how I'd react to that. If someone said, "Look, it's David Crosby," I'd have to go and start asking myself some very, very serious questions.
Well, it took me 2 days to get the answer, and then I shaved my head.
Right. I think that's the point in life when you think, okay, time to go. But you know what? I was so, one of the things about Bowie, obviously, is that great hair. You know, fantastic, fantastic hair. Jealous doesn't even come close to how I feel, you know. Even right up till the end, he always had amazing hair.
Well, and when we were on tour in the fall of 97, when we were in South America, and he wanted his hair, he wanted to get a haircut. He said, "Why don't you just buzz, you know, can you give me a mohawk?" So I had my buzzers, so I gave him a mohawk. And so I mean, by then we had, you know, we had shared enough apartments together when we were making records and stuff that he was my friend and we shared a bathroom. So of course there's a level of intimacy that, you know, like locker room style intimacy that you have with people. So I knew what his hair was like, but when I shaved his head, and it wasn't like I'm looking at David Bowie's follicles. I'm looking at my friend's follicles, like I'd shaved other friends. So I'm just curious about how their hair grows because I'm losing mine. So it's a point of interest. He had a seriously thick head of hair, and there was no gray. He was 52 then, or really? 51 then, and he had maybe a little bit of speckling in his sideburns, and he had some in his goatee, but his hair was, you know, it didn't look like gray. If it was, I just assumed it was blonde. And when you see later pictures of him, you know, in the last couple of years before he passed, that was what his hair came to look like. But that wasn't gray yet either, and he was 69.
I think in the video for Lazarus or Black Star. One of the Lazarus, I think. When he's, you know, he's got the little button eyes and the bandage around his head, and you see. Then I think Visconti had said that he went bald during his chemo, but I think it grew back because in the final photos of him on the opening of the Lazarus stage play, I think that was December 2015, it seemed to look his normal, you know. But in the video, it's definitely white. It looks white there. I don't know if that was makeup or stage effects or what.
I don't know.
So you gave him a buzz cut. That is, wow.
Yes, that's my real claim to fame.
Well, we could just end there right now. I think that's okay.
There. Well, you know, one of the things that I've noticed over time that is sometimes irritating is, like, you know, in my darker moments, some days it's like I've done 10 or 11 albums with David, and I wrote 60 something songs with him, and somebody who gave him a buzz cut will get more attention and more credit and more, just more appreciation for their contribution to the cause. that's the better phrase.
But you've done all of it. You've done all of it, and you've done the buzz cut. I mean, you stand alone, my friend. You stand alone.
I don't think.
Did Carlos Alomar ever give him a buzz cut? Did Mick Ronson ever give him a buzz cut? I mean,
I maybe Mick.
Yeah, yeah.
Mick might have trimmed the ends.
I think so. Come on, David. We're just going to trim a bit of the end off there. Come on, sit down.
We're going to get Exactly.
Sit down, lad. Get scissors out. Come on, trim a little bit there. But I was talking a bit about his birthday because 75, everyone's going to be commemorating it in certain ways. Do you remember celebrating his birthday during the time that you guys were hanging out? Do you remember parties or did he?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of thing would you be getting up to? Any memorable birthdays?
No. They would, like most people in the public eye, the birthdays are generally subdued except for his 50th birthday show at Madison Square Garden. But the birthday dinner was just like four people or six people. And then his last birthday that I celebrated with him was 99, and that was just five people, you know? So six people. That was six people, that's right. But in a little restaurant that he liked. It makes sense when you realize we're all human. But just how... I said this before, and it was one of the only things in Dylan Jones's book that was properly quoted from me. Everything else was, I guess he gave out the tapes to somebody else to transcribe and assumed they were trying. Really? I'm assuming they were he assumed they were transcribed accurately.
Have you been in touch with him to say?
Visconti was bugged by it too, but nobody can be bothered. You know, you can't. I understand as a journalist or someone who appreciates facts. The truth. It would be irritating to you, and I have to believe that he didn't know that the transcription. He wasn't doing his own transcriptions.
I haven't read that book, but my understanding was it was talking to people like yourself, who were very close to David and worked with him and spent time with him and were friends, and asking them for their memories, essentially.
Yeah.
Now, something like that, you have to get right.
I have to believe that he didn't know that the data he was getting was inaccurate in order to be able to accept what happened and not be outraged or not be angry at him specifically.
Yes.
Anyway, but the point of all this, one of the things about, like when you asked about David's birthday, just how tender a lot of it was and how personal and how, with a lot of things like that, you have to protect it from the outside world more, you know? And one of my fondest memories of him was when I was staying at his house, or when we would be working on an album, we'd be sharing an apartment, or just, you know, visiting, going over his place and visiting or whatever. Around 10 o'clock at night, he would have Weetabix with milk in a bowl, and he would sit in the chair with his knees up and hold the bowl and eat it while he was watching TV or while watching a movie or while we were talking. And it was just a thing that he did. But every time I was with him at his home or where we were staying around 10 o'clock at night, Weetabix in a bowl would appear. And it was just like his little night before I go to bed comfort thing. And it's just, you know, when I think back, it's just, it's really sweet. And those are the things that I have to fight to protect and remember, because a lot of the oppressiveness of the external world, the way everybody microscopically looks at everything David did, and people want to pick, and I'm excluding you from all this.
Thank you.
people want the details when you don't want to give it to them, or when it's things that you think are. There's no reason why they should know that. It's just, you know, it's tabloid interest. It's not artistic interest, you know. And those are the things that I kind of mostly keep to myself, because they are lovely and sweet and should not be corrupted. And the rest of the energy goes to protecting the music that's, for the most part, you know, sealed in the medium that it was committed to.
But you know,
when you do a box set, you've got to deal with people remastering and getting in there and monkeying around and doing remixes. But, you know, so it seems like a lot of life is just keeping from people, keeping the industry that surrounds the art from tearing into the sweetness.
Yes. No, I can understand that. I mean, those moments are precious. Those moments are things that you are very personal and that you cherish.
Yeah.
You told me last time that after he died, you had people approaching you wanting sort of to rake over every last detail with you, which must be incredibly difficult to deal with when you're still processing your own grief.
Yeah, I basically just shut everything down, you know. After I did two interviews, one of which I shouldn't, short interviews, one of which I regret because it was just a bad interview, not because of anything I did, but it was just a pointless interview. Sorry. And, you know, it's the nature of the beast. And it was, I must bug me because I mentioned it in the last time we spoke, but I don't think of it as really bugging me, but I guess it's something that's I'm always aware of. And, you know, it goes, as David warned me early on, that's, you know, it's different when we leave the room.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's us when we're in the room, but when we go outside, it's going to be completely different. And you know, sadly, in the post-Trump, post-COVID, post-truth world, it's not getting any better.
Yes, I know.
Let's talk about Timothy.
On that note, let's talk about Timothy. So you were talking about being on the road with Timothy. So let's start with the second album then. So that was done in Australia. It feels more fully realised than the first album. I understand the first album was done fairly quickly. There's more going on, isn't there? What was the interband dynamic like going into the album? Were you guys still hanging together pretty well? Were you?
I've learned over time that even sometimes you read things that people say about their bandmates and it sounds like they hate them. And in fact, it's just sort of like, yeah, you know, your brother was always a pain in the ass, you know, and your sister wasn't any better. And that's your mom saying that, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, she would still kill for them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that. There was just, you know, there were things where, you know, they were trying it on in the early days because I was a complete stranger to them. And the last time I saw them was when Iggy Pop with the Ramones opening in 1977 in New York City.
Thank you.
So he wanted to get in his autograph. And we waited in the pouring rain at the stage door after the show. And I was like, fuck this. You know, I mean, I was 20 at that point. But I was like, you know, fuck this. Let's go get a cup of coffee and get warm. And Hunt and Tony came out on their way to the bus from the stage door and didn't want to have anything to do with any of us.
Did you remind them of that?
I don't think I've ever told them that story, but there was an element of that when we all met. And Hunt was wearing a T-shirt that said "Fuck you, I'm from Texas," and he had a, you know, an 8-inch blade knife on his belt. And Tony was, you know, being the young Bobby De Niro, and you know. That was their, and they were, you know, we're the Sales Brothers. Who the fuck are you? That was the attitude.
Didn't Hunt still have that T-shirt in Tin Machine? Fuck you, I'm in Tin Machine.
We all had those.
You all had those. I remember seeing that.
There was a rabid core that followed us around to every show, like 50 people, and we had T-shirts made that said, "Fuck you, I heart Tin Machine." you know, and they would, and then we met ones made that said, fuck you, I'm in Tin Machine, just for the band.
Yeah, yeah.
You know who has one that I saw in a picture she was wearing is Florence in the Machine.
Oh, no
Florence.
Way, really?
She has a, and I guess because it says Machine in it. Anyway, about the question, we, you know, we had done our promotion. It was kind of a short tour or a promotional tour or whatever, but we played small places and it felt like a band very quickly in the studio. And we went from like the fuck you, who are you, to, oh, okay, to, hey, that's my pal, you know, kind of stuff.
Right.
And pretty quickly. And in a way, when we started the Tin Machine record, David had brought Kevin Armstrong in, who had played on Absolute Beginners, because I guess we didn't know we were going to be a band. We were just doing them. So he and I had been writing, and then Hunt and Tony and Tim Palmer came in, and Kevin came in. And I think pretty quickly it became, because I lobbied against making it a band initially, and I also lobbied against, once I realized I was losing the battle on the band front, that I lobbied against Kevin not being included in the band. And for whatever reason, he didn't kind of gel with everybody, and the brothers they got along. Everybody was getting along great, got along well enough. And David had his reasons, and I was just like, you know, fine, I'll be fine being the only guitar player if that's what it's going to be. But, you know, I've done that, but, you know, this has a thing too. And then we went. So it was decided relatively early on that Kevin was tour support.
Yes,
essentially. Yes. And I think, you know, David put his picture on the album kind of because he needed to be, you know, he was getting credited as for playing rhythm guitar and piano and stuff, and but he was part of that process. And he did, you know, he kind of didn't seem that interested in being in it. He's more interested in being part of the history now than he was in actually being with the band. And he wasn't always the most complimentary to what we were doing. And when you're writing songs quickly and carefully together, or quickly together, I don't know how careful we were, that it's like one of the things I learned from David, that it's like, and I might have said this last time, it's like trying to build a fire outdoors with kindling and flint.
Yes.
And you just got to keep trying to make the fire start. And when you get the spark, you have to crowd around it and protect it from the elements, which I would say that would be, you know, critical analysis. If you're going to look at that and critique it at that stage, you can't, because it hasn't blossomed into what it is, you know. So you have to nurture it until it has legs and it becomes the thing, or indicates the thing it's going to be. And then you can start to take a more critical approach if you want. Personally, I think you have to suspend criticism until you get it almost completed.
That's something,
and then walk away from it for a little bit.
That's something I think a lot of people struggle with, is how to suspend that that inner critical dialogue that's going on.
Yeah.
You know, and like you said, that's a very good analogy. Allowing something to take root, to form a body of its own and actually have substance before you knock it all to pieces with external
and
forces.
And I think some of what we did was... David realized that there was perhaps more criticism of what we were doing in the room than we needed at the time. So that's what led to things going that way. And in the second tour, I had a friend in Boston who we had taken each other's place in bands, and I was a little more of he was a little more of a field player, and I was more of a technical player, but we had the same sense of time and stuff. And he Eric Skirmerhorn, he played guitar on the second tour.
Yes, yes.
With us. Because David maintained he was going to do all the rhythm. He was going to play guitar with me on the second tour. And the material on the second tour was a little more sophisticated than the first record. And I didn't think that a lot of those voicings were going to be David's, just you know, some of the more complicated chord voicings that were key to the song, I thought were not in David's hands. Mm. They were just not the way he played. Yeah. And so I kind of anticipated that it wasn't going to happen that way. So I talked to my friend and I said, I think we're going to audition guitar players to go on tour, because Kevin didn't want to do the second tour with us. And
this is when you're touring the second album, yes?
The second album, yeah. And so blah, blah. So we brought him in. But to go back to your question, which I'm still trying to get back to. So when I was writing for the second record, we all had ideas. We had some leftover material that we didn't put on. Actually, there's a lot of leftover material from Tin Machine 1.
Yeah.
But I'll get...
I know, I wanted to ask you about this. Yeah.
So there are a couple of songs that we actually had almost... We had pretty much almost completed that we didn't finish. So we had that. But I had been writing stuff for the next record, because I knew how Hunt and Tony played. I knew what it felt like to be down in the engine room with them, you know, and where their time sat in relation to metronomic time, and what I had a sense of the feel, and I could see where we were going. I knew we had been someplace as a band. We had been the first record, and we had done the short tour. So there were places where to push ahead, and I thought that was harmonically.
Yeah.
So songs like Betty Wrong and Am Lepura, and I had been working on those it was only a couple of months between when we finished touring and when we went to Australia. Yeah. So there wasn't a lot of time to, and then I kept writing, like You Belong in Rock and Roll just came out as something I was messing around with, and the idea I had that I had a harmonizer that I was writing programs for a company that I had fallen in love with. And it was more than just a harmonizer. It had a lot of other sounds in it. But it also did what they call diatonic pitch shift. So you can put any sound into it and tell it what key you want it to make a harmony in.
Yes.
And what interval. So I thought, well, what if I put machine noise into that and tell it I want that machine to be in the key of G and to give me the thirds, only thirds on one side and only sevenths on the other. And then I got the idea, well, what if I had a variable speed motor? Because I know motors, when you get near a motor or like a refrigerator or even a TV, with distortion or gain on your pickups, it'll pick up the sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it'll go through your amp. Yeah. And it'll go through whatever effects you have. Because I remember years ago, with an early form of the harmonizer, playing a note or getting ready to start a song with a band I had in Boston, and this was like 85, 80, standing there waiting for the drummer to count the song in, and we used to rehearse in the kitchen of the house we lived in.
Was that for the sound or just for practical space reasons?
It was because we didn't have a kitchen table, and so we set the band up there.
Right.
It was the only other place in the house we could play. And we put milk cartons on the wall and blankets. And anyway, I'm standing there waiting for the drummer to count the song, and he's going, one, two. And the refrigerator came on. The sound of the refrigerator came through my pickups, through my distortion pedal, into my harmonizer, and out through my speaker cabinet.
Wow.
And it just sounded like, ah! You know, so I remember that. And 5 years later, I asked my tech, you know, do you have like a Dremel or a small drill?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, what do you need? And I said, well, I need a small variable speed motor I can hold in my hand. He goes, you need a vibrator. And I said, well, yeah, that will work, I guess. And he goes, well, there's a sex shop right down the street from where we're in Australia. We're in Sydney, right? So we go down there, and I'm listening to them to hear the key of the motor, you know, where the bass, the root note of the motor is, kind of, and how broad the sweep is. And the guy's looking at me, and they were waiting to close. We got in there right at the end.
Are you going
to
buy one of those things or not?
And what's with the...
Why you listening to them?
And so I picked two that were silver, so they didn't look, they looked more like tools than marital aids, as they call them, or sex aids. And I'm checking, I'm at the counter, it's just me and a guy cleaning up with and in there, and my guitar tech and I, and Andy Spray was the name of my guitar tech. the second employee turns the vacuum cleaner on to start vacuuming the shop, and I hear the motor noise, and I look, and the guy behind behind the counter, the guy behind the counter looks at me and goes, "No." So, you know, but so I what I did was on You Belong in Rock and Roll is I dialed out the original signal,
yeah,
and I went for thirds and sevenths of motor noise held on my pickups. Yeah. That's me turning the motor speed on the vibrator,
right,
over my pickups through the harmonizer.
I also remember there was such a kerfuffle in the media when you were on Wogan. I think you were on Wogan or Top of the Pops playing a vibrator, and the tabloids had such a, you know, a moral hysteria. Who's this, you know, who's this savage with Bowie?
Yeah,
playing,
well, you know,
playing
what
a dildo on TV, primetime television.
They wouldn't let me use it on Top of the Pops.
Right. Did you use something else?
I used an eclair, because they wouldn't let me use it because they thought it was obscene.
Yeah.
And we were miming anyway, which I hated doing Top of the Pops for that reason. I think I played it years later on Earthling. I think I wore my guitar left-handed or something on one of the times. You know, on the other hand, it's nice to know that I'd done it enough times that I can't remember what I did. But...
was it an eclair, vibrator?
But so the eclair, Andy Spray, my guitar tech, put it in a little box or in a box on top of my amp. I said, put it on the box. So he got it from somewhere, put it on a box on top of my amp, and he even painted the box black so no one would notice it, you know. And when it came time for the solo, instead of reaching over for the vibrator, I reached over for the eclair, and I just wiped it up and down the neck of my guitar. And I was using this completely chromed Steinberger. So it was just this shining, gleaming metal guitar-looking guitar. And but what I did at the end of it, for the course of the solo, I just smeared it up and down the strings. And at the very end, I wiper-bladed it off the strings. And in the original Top of the Pops episode, I think they re-edited it after the fact, but I wiper bladed it and it shot off the neck and went right onto the camera lens.
Wow.
So it was the money shot, basically. And so you want something that's not obscene? I think they also threw one of our bass tech out that day because he moved a cable that was laying across that someone dropped on the bass player's pedals, that's non-union.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't touch the. Well, that's always a shock to the Americans when they play Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
How strong the union is, which I'm all for strong unions. That happened to us at Madison Square Garden too, though.
For the birthday celebration.
Yeah, because there was a lot of stuff. Well, going on. I think actually that was the only time I played Madison Square Garden with David. So maybe I never noticed it. Oh, we did get asked. Yeah, the union's just heavy there. Not as bad as Cleveland. So one of the things that we had kind of done without discussion, but then we discussed it when we realized we weren't doing it on the first record, was no synthesizers.
Yes.
The only keyboards would be acoustic or traditional. Like you could have we could have organ.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say like that kind of garage punk sound. You know, you get a Farfisa or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I played B3 on Stateside.
Yeah.
Because I felt like what I, my thing in my my personal thing at that point was there. I felt there's enough sounds in the electric guitar that I can, by changing whether I, it's like, if you think of it visually, it's like if there's a small bit of nice aging on a piece of pottery, and you look at it and you think, wow, that's awesome. That would almost be, make a great painting if you could blow it up or expand it or paint. So what I was doing sonically was finding the thing that was like a little crack in the pottery, a little squeak that happened in my guitar when I moved, but then blowing it up so it was much larger and more important than it should have been. So, and then using that as part of the music, finding a way to make that sound musical instead of using a synthesizer. And so that was a good chunk of the way we approach things. But for You Belong in Rock and Roll, I wanted something that, and industrial hadn't been coined as a word yet, I don't think.
It was very much on the fringes at that time, you know.
And I was trying to find that.
Yeah.
You know, because I grew up in, you know, originally a band, like Ministry was a Boston band.
Right, right.
So I knew that band. And Nine Inch Nails were doing what they were doing, but they hadn't, I think Pretty Hate Machine had come out, hadn't come out yet. Because that came out while we were on our second Tin Machine tour. But there was enough precedent for that, that I could, and I was having trouble explaining things sometimes, but because I could get my hands on the board, I could make it so, you know, I could say, this is what I'm thinking. And then, you know, but you can tone it down a little, you know.
It's a very painterly approach.
It's probably an art school thing.
Yeah.
And it's probably where that was the place that David and I met. It's like the place where we met creatively, I think, was because one of the first things we did when we did Look Back in Anger, he goes, I kind of want it. The guitars to sound like, you know, like a German Gothic cathedral with the flying buttresses. And I looked at him and I went, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Commented on that, the fact that he would say stuff like that, and I would go, oh yeah, all right. And then I would explain to him like a certain melodic sonic motif thing that I was hearing, that is like, that's the repeated form of the buttress going down the sides of the structure, and
that's and such, it's such a fundamental part of a collaboration, isn't it, when you can see what the other is saying and you can translate that, you can take what he says and run with it and actually realize it. That visual sense.
There's the intellectual knowledge of it, and the fact, you know, the fear. I mean, that's been an ongoing debate I've had for years. Like, everyone wants to be the noble savage, but you can be the noble, you can be the noble professor if you want. You know, I can turn on my ignorance if I need to. But I can also use it to make these larger, more elaborate, and still primal connections for me. They're not intellectualized. It's an intellectual connect, but, you know.
It goes back to what you're saying now about that kind of intellectual analysis can then also kill an idea.
But that's if I'm really intellectualizing. And in fact, I've just got a bigger toolbox.
Yeah.
You know, I've got more hatchets and bear claws on my in my belt that's holding up my loincloth than the other savage. That's all.
Yeah.
I'm just another savage that's slightly more, got my shit slightly more together.
You're a better equipped savage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
better savagery through technology.
How about the other tracks then on Tin Machine 2? So. Like you said, it feels more substantial. It feels fuller, more realized. You're experimenting with more textures. But did you feel that you were, you know, was that like a general group thing to move into a more richly textured sound, or did you think, well, it's a balance between your explorations and the kind of garage rock spontaneity of Tin Machine?
I think what the difference is, and it's the camps are kind of divided on that. There's a lot of people that like the first record mm-hmm. because it's of its urgency
yeah.
and it's more like ah, whereas the second record was more like eh, you know, it was like there's more thought in the angst. Yeah.
What was it Bowie said? It's but, sensitively aggressive.
Yeah, yeah.
Or aggressively sensitive. I don't know which one it was.
Well, I think the first one was sensitively aggressive. The second one was aggressively sensitive. I like the live record.
Oh, me myself. Too. Me too.
Yeah. Because it was, we did it with the knowledge of both records and having played the songs. So it had some of the sophistication, the additional sophistication or whatever. I know sophistication is the wrong word. It was has some of the second record and it still has the intensity yes. of the first record.
Yes. I mean, it got panned in the press. I think it got such, you know, like, oh, this is dreadful. I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you, but I could not see what the problem was. I loved that version of, that was the first time I heard the song, If There Was Something, you know, and you go out, you stretch out into that long jam and it just goes on forever. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole Heaven's In Here where he starts going into I'm a King Bee.
Like a king, babe, buzzing round your heart. I'm a king bee, baby, buzzing round your hive. I've been buzzing all morning, won't you let me come inside? Buzz away.
You know, that was what we were.
Yeah.
That is the, and there was one, one bass note fixed and two added moments where we added backing vocals.
Right.
Just because the mic wasn't, or somebody forgot to sing or whatever. So my point is, that's what we sounded like. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah,
and we mixed it with a friend of mine who I worked with in Boston named Tom Duby, who was producer or engineer, and our front of house guy Max Bisgrove. So the three of us mixed it together, and you know, normally you don't. I don't know why more people don't bring their front of house guy into the studio to mix live, you know, or at least to mix live records.
I mean,
we do that
with
the Cure.
Yeah. Yeah,
we work with Paul Corky, who's our front of house guy. I mean, he co-produced the Blood Flowers album, you know, and we're working on him with him on the new stuff. So, you know, it just makes sense if you like what you do live, and that is a difference too, because a lot of bands are always trying to sound as good as their records,
right?
Live, and we are always trying to have our studio records have the thing our live performance
yeah,
has.
Yeah.
So
exactly,
you know,
the first record to me sounds pretty much live. You know,
and we'd never played a show.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Is that firstly you said earlier on that when you went into doing the second record, you knew how these guys worked, you knew what their, you know, what they responded to, and you knew how to write music for Tin Machine. But that first record, it really is to me like I had such a earworm the other day. I really wanted to hear Heaven's In Here. It just been stuck in my head all day. The big sound, and when you do these kind of like colossal big guitar freakouts.
When we recorded the first album version, we just maybe it was the second. David and I had done. There is a version of that we, David and I, when we wrote it, we recorded it with Drum Machine.
Heaven's In Here.
Yeah. So we played it for Hunt and Tony, and then we went in and we tracked it, and I think maybe we did it twice.
Mm.
And the second version, when we got to the end where it goes, ba ba.
Yeah.
And there's drum fills, ba ba. We were just going to either fade it or let it end. We hadn't really thought about how we're going to end it. Hunt and I kept playing, and everybody else put down their instruments and went into the control room because they thought we were done. Because after we had gone bah, bah, enough time, there was enough time to end it on. And so he and I played for that entire like solo, or I always think of it as more a duet.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's like you're dueling.
Well, yeah, it's a dogfight. Yeah. I think of World War One. You know, probably in another dimension though. Anyway, we did that to the end, and we even ended it where it's like, duh, duh, yeah. Bam.
Yeah.
That was the way, and it was just Hunt and I playing. And then we went back up to the control room, and we're trying to walk into the control room, and this was at Mountain Studios. And as we're trying to get in the room, which was kind of cramped, Tony's pushing his way out. and he's talking to Dave Richard, or he's talking to Tim Palmer. He's going, I'm just gonna let me just put bass down on the end.
Yeah.
And he's just like, just before I forget, and he just pushed past us. And he plugged in and they rolled him, gave him a little pre-roll, and he came in right where he had stopped and played through to the end, and that was it.
That's amazing. He did his bass.
But I would go back to it being the fact that they were brothers.
Right. So they had this kind of connection. Yeah, yeah.
And we also kind of connected that this sort of like Cream Hendrix power trio live thing in there. Because
your licks there are very Hendrix. When you and Hunt are dueling, you're just ripping out these huge Hendrix style, big, big licks.
And I was playing a Stratocaster and it was all, you know, kind of, the vibe was sort of there. And I was using like the sound I was using was less friendly to playing than the sound I would normally go for, but it was because we were doing a basic, but I was still thinking, that was like the first song we did, I think, together in the studio. And I was thinking it was a basic track and I would maybe overdub the guitar solo later, I didn't know. And so I hadn't set myself up to have a comfortable sound for the solo at the end, so I had to work harder. So when I have to work harder, I tend to take a step back to things that are a little rootsier,
right?
For me, my roots would be like Hendrix blues, kind of, you know. So I did fall back into that a little bit for that. And when I hear it now, it's kind of, I sound semi-arthritic sometimes to me, but it was the right thing for the moment. And apparently, you know, people that like Tin Machine like that solo. So.
Oh, it's fantastic. It really is fantastic. But I'm surprised that was a Strat. I didn't see you as a Strat player. I can't remember seeing people playing a Strat.
Yeah. There's a Steinberger on every song on the spine guitar.
Yes, yes.
On each song. On every Tin Machine track is my Steinberger, my little one with the cricket bat size one. And then the solos are split like 50-50 between whether I played. I ended up doing almost all of the solos on the basic tracks on the first record. And so it depended on which guitar I was using on the basic, and it was almost always the Steinberger. And on the second record, about half of the solos are the Stratocaster.
Okay.
But you know, the Strat thing had been done to death.
Yeah.
In when, you know, people tend to hear with their eyes a lot of the time, so I wanted something that was going to be a departure from, because we were hearkening back to another time, improvisational rock time, but we were also looking forward in another way. I wanted something that summed that up, a guitar that had no history in a way. And that was to me, the Steinberger. But some of the other songs on that. Oh, well, you can always tell which one we wrote in the studio together because there's multiple writing credits on the second record. And here was the other thing that was different about the second record was, I think we pulled Tim Palmer way out of his comfort zone. I talked to Tim all the time I just talked to him yesterday. He was used to the producer's going to run this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll tell you how we're going to record. And we were like, we're going to do a song a day, top to bottom, but not mixed. And then when we're done with that, then we'll go back and look at it. And we didn't succeed in doing actually a song every day, but we were close to that because we only spent on the first record, I'm thinking, we mm-hmm. only spent like 3 weeks actually recording.
It was very fast, wasn't it?
And then we were kind of mixing a little bit as we went. It was pre-Pro Tools, so we were still dealing with, we were using digital tape, but we were still dealing with tape. But Tim was used to, you do all the basics in the first couple of weeks, and then you go back and you do the vocals, and then you do the overdubs.
Right. Yes, yes.
Like, and you think in advance, okay, I'm going to use this amp guitar combination. Which songs do I want that on? So we'll go through and do all. And we weren't having any of that.
Right.
Everything was mic'd up. I had four amps mic'd. So we'll record them all and we'll pick the ones that work. You know, I'll play it once, but there'll be four tracks.
Yeah.
So we kind of turned Tim's world on its head, and he was game. He was up for it. He was digging it. But by the end of it, after we got done with mixing, I think he was kind of tired of all of us,
right.
But particularly tired of two of us.
Right.
And
diplomatic.
And yeah, which is kind of pointless at this stage of the game. But he said to me, he goes, Why don't you guys go? And his wife was pregnant. This was right. The other thing, and she was about ready to have the baby, or he had just had a baby. That's right. She had the baby while we were mixing Tin Machine One, so he said, and to go to Australia from London when I've got a new baby, that's a little bit too far for me. So why don't you guys go and work on the basics? Because the record was said produced by Tin Machine and Tim Palmer anyway. So, you know, I lobbied for it saying produced by David Reeves and Tim Palmer, but that didn't go down very well. So we went to Sydney without Tim, and we were scheduled to be there for 3 months initially. Hunt and Tony came over. We did some tracking. They were there for about 2 weeks, and they wanted to go home. They wanted to go back to L.A. They felt like they had done what they came to do. I think if they would have stayed, we would have recorded more new songs, mm-hmm. but they wanted to go home. So David was like, okay, well, you know, you guys can go home, and maybe we'll do something later.
Right.
You know, we'll do more songs elsewhere or something if we need more. So to go back to the textural change in that record, that's kind of what you get when you give me a month. When you give me a month
yes.
to fuck around in the studio when the basic tracks are already recorded.
So that must have been amazing, though. You've got all the tracks.
Well, I had a great time.
Yeah, and you have this wonderful canvas to work with.
Yeah, and I was aware of the limitations that we had put on it on the first record, and I honored those. Mm. Pretty much.
What limitations did you set for yourself artistically?
Well, the fact no electronic keyboards,
right.
nothing too polished.
Mm-hmm.
To err on the side of aggression was key to the sound of that record. I think to both records we could lay back more, or we could be more in your face. Oh, we're going to be more in your face, and. So that was pretty much the approach, and not to go too crazy with the textures and not move it too far away from what we were, which was a live band. Mm. But a song like Big Hurt was one that we wrote spontaneously in the studio.
That came out of a jam.
Mr. Ed. Well, no, we were kind of jamming a little bit, but we were jamming with the thought in mind of we're going to get a thing and then we're going to tighten it up and make it into a song.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to some jams are just that. Let's see this. You Can't Talk. Yeah. Over, under, out. You can't talk. You can't see me coming. You can't talk. I don't see you swimming. You can't talk. You want to go your way. You can't talk. I know you don't blow me. Look at this. Tony and I wrote before David got to Australia. The first day we were in the studio getting sounds before he had gotten there, because he was a couple of days behind us, and he was flying from the UK and we were flying from LA. That we wrote as an instrumental and played it for David, and he was like, oh, I got an idea. And Big Hurt, You Can't Talk. I really should have the album in front of me so you know what songs
Baby
are on.
Universal.
Baby Universal was one we had messed around with for the first record, but we redid.
Oh, so that originated the second record from those sessions.
Yeah, David and I were trying to write a Hawkwind song.
Hence all the phasing and the
yeah, and
very and true, was, very Lemmy bass player.
Yeah, and I played bass on the original for the pick, so I was Tony made the bass line better and more. Well, he just made. Let's just say he made it better because he did. I think the baby.
Yeah.
We didn't have that when we did it when we sketched it out in for the first record.
So it would have started with a verse, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you guys came up with that wonderful phasing baby talk.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, which changed live. David sang a different answer to the babies every night. So the adjectives and stuff that are in there would get, sometimes he would actually have a reason why he was changing it, and he would write it on a piece of duct tape and put it on the floor in front of his monitor as sound check so he could read it. And then other times it would just do it off the top of his head, like Underworld song, Born Slippy.
Yeah, Lager, 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 Lager.
Lager, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, fortunately, we were a few years ahead of that, and it's just a conceptual approach to things, and I'm sure millions of other people have done it before, so we don't have to deal with being told that we copied it from Underworld.
It's still, what a great opener that is. And that intro just adds that drama. And I had always wanted to do
that thing where Clapton quoted, was it Blue Moon?
Yeah, in
or Strangers in the Night.
No, he quotes Blue Moon in, is it in White Room or is it in Sunshine? Yeah, Sunshine of Your Love. He quotes Blue Moon.
And Hendrix quotes Strangers in the Night in another song. So I'm not sure what I can't remember what. Da, na, 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 na. Na, 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 na. I think it's the song, More Than the Greatest Love, the world has no more. Na, 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 na. It's like the second half of the verse, the melody from the second half of the verse.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought instead of, going in with both guns blazing, I did something with and I had a primitive version of the sustainer guitar that Steinberg, not a primitive version, actually, a very evolved version of a sustainer pickup in a Steinberger that Ned Steinberger had loaned me. And the only problem with it was that the guitar would get hot after an hour of being plugged in because it was electricity, however he was doing it, and magnetics, and it was inside that little square Steinberger body.
Yeah.
And if you had it on, you would take it off and you'd have a square wet patch on your shirt because it was that hot, it was making you sweat.
Oh, my God.
So it was kind of like one of those things, you can use it, but only use it on two songs because it might blow up.
Well, that adds a definite air of drama to the music, doesn't it? When your guitar is literally in danger of exploding if you play it too much.
Yeah, yeah.
What a climax to the show that would have been, though.
Right. I think it might have just melted into my shirt and my flesh, though. The climax might have been me running around screaming at the top.
And on guitar, Reeves Gabrels. Oh, my God, what's happened?
There he goes again.
He's literally on fire. So how long were the sessions then for Tin Machine 2? So did that, in total then, with all the recording in London and Australia?
We only mixed in the UK, and we mixed at Eel Pie. We used Townsend's studio. Place.
Yeah.
We did 2 months in Australia, and then we decided we'd done enough. We didn't need to be there any longer. Yeah. And it was really pleasant at the old Sydney EMI 301 studios. I mean, it was really a great place to record. And, two in the afternoon on Fridays, they'd come around with trays of gin and tonics.
How civilized.
They'd walk into the session with a tray of gin and tonics. Wow. It was another time,
yeah.
You know.
Why did you choose Australia in the first place?
It was away from everybody.
Pretty much.
You know, yes. I mean, away from the industry, yes, largely. And David had a place there that he and I could stay in. And it was being nice. It, you know, we tried to... David talked about this a lot in the early days with me, you know, who had never really had the opportunity to get disgusted with studio life. Mm. You know, like I was in the studio a lot through my 20s, but I was in there for the duration it took to do the thing I was there to do. I never had the experience of moving in for months with a band into a place. I was always like, it was always local to where I lived, and it was always, you know, we're going to go in and do three songs, and then we're going to save up more money and go and do another three songs, and then go back a month later and do another three songs in a day, and then the album's done.
Yeah.
That was my experience. So, but David's thing was, you know, we're living our lives here. This is not, we're not going to work. We're not, we may be good at the craft, but we're not craftsmen. We're not, you know, we're artists.
Yeah.
And so when we get there, it should be a total experience. You know, we should go to movies and we should go to museums, which we did all the time, you know, when we had a day off or when we had an evening off or whatever, or when time permitted. And like I said, you know, the Art Brut in Lausanne, that museum played a huge role for me in Tin Machine and how I approached the music. And ultimately it came back around when we were doing the Outside record.
Well, of course, I mean. Yeah.
But because the art of the incarcerated and the insane, if that's not rock music, what is?
It was interesting because I was wondering, how does that affect you, your immediate environment? Because I've done quite a few conversations with various people who've worked with Bowie to various extents. And one of the few things that people all seem to agree on was that he was incredibly influenced by his surroundings. I mean, there was a real awareness of where he was.
Oh, no, totally. I mean, the line from Amlapura, "Hey, hey, it's the Tall Ships."
Yeah.
While he and I were there, in the second month, he started taking sailboat lessons, like how to. I know there's a much better way to put that. What is it called?
I don't know what the word is. Very.
He was going to make the boat work.
He was going to get the boat working. Yeah. Yeah.
And in talking to this older seafaring gentleman who was being his instructor, he said, they were talking about stuff, and he started reading about the boogie pirates who would dress up in women's clothing and make believe their ship was listing and abandoned. And then the ship would come over, and as soon as they pulled up and threw the lines across, these guys would swing over it with their daggers and their sabers and their dresses and kill the other crew and take the other crew's boat.
Wow.
Boogie pirates.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, and that's often the beauty in a lot of what, even as a kid, when I was, my mom got me Ziggy Stardust. You know, the little words, little fragments, or little things alluded to, or the Signet. You know, when I went back and bought his earlier records after that, you know, there's little things that get mentioned that, you know, we didn't have the internet then, but we had encyclopedias. You know, so I would start I went to the library when I was a kid, like we go to Google now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I discovered I could go to a library and look things up, that was how I was going to spend my Saturdays. But I was not, you know, I don't know what that made me.
I think for many fans, though, David was a sort of portable library. He was, certainly for me, many people like me, in a pre-internet era, we would only become aware of things through being a Bowie fan or a Beatles fan or a Dylan fan. You know, that would give you that frame of reference. So through Bowie, say I would find out about the Velvet Underground, or I'd find out about Aleister Crowley, or I'd find out about Iggy Pop. You know what I mean? You know, you go exploring and find out more and more and more.
Yeah, and if you know if you're serious about whatever your central pursuit is in your life, when your heroes in that mention who influenced them, if you're smart, you go back and find out about them.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. It's like, you know, if you like Hendrix, then you go back and you listen to Albert King. And if you listen to Albert King, you go back and listen to Lonnie Johnson. And if you like Lonnie Johnson, you'll go back, you know, to Robert Johnson and you know.
And just keep going as far back as you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's how you become. That's how you become the thing you're trying to become.
Yes.
And I still, you know, you could kind of hear it in the way I speak, I guess. But I still like the bonehead side of things too. Like I like the you know, bone by bonehead. What do I mean?
Me too. I mean, we
fog hat. Fog hat.
Who doesn't like fog hat? Come on. There you go. Dumpy's rusty nuts. Well,
yeah, you know. I mean, that's there you go.
Yeah.
And I can, I mean, art is, there's high art and low art, but it's all art.
Robert Johnson was a lone man.
He didn't have a lawyer.
Robert Johnson.
Okay. Feel all right? Audio's okay?
We're all right. Yes, good.
The ghosts of Manhattan shrieking as they fall on AT&T.
And that was part two of Reeves Gabrels on Album to Album. And a sincere thanks to him for his time and generosity in sharing these wonderful anecdotes and memories. And thanks, of course, to you for listening. We're still very much in the early stages of our journey through Reeves's time with David, so I hope to bring you more as soon as I can. In the meantime, please do share and review this podcast and let me know what you think of it. There's loads more in the pipeline, so fingers crossed, more very soon indeed. Till next time, stay safe, stay well, and bye for now.